Okay, we gotta get started. It's 8:01. Do you know where your students are? They saw the exam, decided to change their majors to biology. Okay, we're gonna start a new section of the course. We're gonna start what I'm calling part two, and so for the next many weeks, we're going to talk about molecular spectroscopy. We're going to start out with some rather mundane properties of light, but actually they could be interesting if you, are so inclined. And we're going to need to understand the properties of light or electromagnetic radiation in order to understand the principles behind certain analytical techniques that use those properties of light. And we will talk about the components of the instruments that are used to measure these things, sources. We'll talk about detectors, monochromators, ways of selecting wavelengths. Then we'll put the instruments together, okay, sort of in a virtual sense. Okay, we'll build instruments. We'll talk primarily about UV visible absorption. We'll talk toward the end of the course about fluorescence. And I'll mention as I go along infrared spectroscopy and sources and components, because there's a very great overlap between conventional energy dispersive style infrared instruments and UV visible absorption instruments. And so we'll know how those all work when we're all done. We'll have an exam in, several weeks, maybe 4 or 5 weeks, we'll have another exam. I will grade the exam that you took the other day. I hate grading, but I'll get to it. And so I'll have an exam partway through after we've talked about components and properties of electromagnetic radiation, and then we'll talk more about the theoretical aspects of spectra, what the spectra mean, and things like that. Then we'll have an exam at the end on that material. Okay, you know the website. There's a second website listed here that has basically a course on photonics. And what we're doing is not technically photonics in the physics department. They have a photonics program. They have a photonics center located at Hanscom Air Force Base, I believe, or the Lincoln Lab or someplace like that. And the properties of electromagnetic radiation and the ways in which they're measured, there's an overlap between photonics and optical methods of, analytical chemistry. And so this little course here, if you go into it, it's got some really good stuff, some good graphics, some good lessons on various aspects of electromagnetic radiation. So I give you that so you can go there and look at that. That course, if you'd like another explanation of the material, another description of what we're talking about. All right, we're going to start out very basic, define spectroscopy, methods based on interaction of electromagnetic radiation and matter. So we're going to take light and we're going to interact it with matter, and now all of a sudden we're doing spectroscopy. Electromagnetic radiation, it says here, is a form of energy with both wave and particle properties. We're just talking about light, but we're talking about the difference between waves of light and quanta of light, okay? Photons. What's the difference? There is no difference. It's just a different description of the same thing. It's still light, okay? But we can describe it in the classic sense as waves, or we can describe it as bundles of energy, as photons, and most of the time, the wave process is sort of easier to fit into our understanding, but both are perfectly valid ways of describing electromagnetic radiation. And sometimes, and I'll give you both in some cases, but we'll talk primarily about waves. So here we have electromagnetic radiation moving through space as a wave. So the wave is propagating in this direction. It's moving through space, and as it moves through space, of course, there is an electric oscillating electric vector, Okay? So the electronic component of the electromagnetic radiation is oscillating as it goes through, as it travels through space. There is at the right at 90 degrees to that a magnetic vector. Okay, magnetic vector. We never talk about the magnetic vector when it comes to spectroscopy. We only talk about the electric vector. And so we got this electromagnetic radiation. It's electric field, or it's the electronic part of it. And actually, I sort of misspoke here. A true vector is these arrow representations of the amplitude of the wave as it travels through space. So we can define electromagnetic radiation in this way, in this context. And if we're going to do that, we're going to use this wave equation, or what I'll call an equation describing electromagnetic radiation in terms of frequency and wavelength. Okay, so nu is the frequency, lambda is the wavelength. You got to learn your Greek alphabet. Not that I know it or anything. And then we have c is the speed of light in a vacuum. And then n, I don't know if that's the Greek n. It might have some other name. But that is refractive index. So what I'm trying to say with this equation is light is going to have a frequency, okay, number of oscillations per second. It's going to have some wavelength, all right, the length of a single wave of light, all right, and then it's going to have some speed, all right. If it's going through a vacuum, we know what the speed is, and then that is going to be related by this term, this refractive index. Now, as it turns out, when light it says down here, electromagnetic radiation slows down in medium other than a vacuum. So light's coming along. It's traveling from outer space, which is a vacuum. Okay, it comes from the sun, let's say, as an example. And it's traveling along, and it hits the Earth's atmosphere, which is a medium, which is a substance, right? It's made of gases. Maybe it's made as water vapor and other things. Or it travels from a vacuum into water. Okay, that's probably a better example. And now, all of a sudden, the electric vectors of the radiation are going to be influenced by the water molecules. Why is it going to be influenced? Because the water molecules have electric fields too, right? They've got electrons buzzing around them, and they've got electric fields. And we've got electric fields from this electronic vector, or these electronic vectors in the wavelengths of light. And so there's going to be an interaction of those electric vectors with the electric fields in matter. That's going to cause the propagation of the light to slow down. It's not going to travel as fast in water. Okay, it goes through, well, light goes through water, right? But it's not going to travel as fast through water as it does through a vacuum. All right? So there's going to be a change in the speed, or the forward propagation of this light. The frequency of the radiation is not going to change. Okay, the frequency, so this is a constant. Okay, that frequency is a constant. The speed of light in a vacuum is also a constant. In other words, if we're talking vacuum, it's always the same in a vacuum. When it comes to another medium, it's going to change. So this term, or this parameter, C, is also a constant. But something's going to change because light is passing from the vacuum into water, and it's interacting with these electric vectors. And what's going to change, first of all, is that light that's traveling at some speed is going to put on the brakes and slow down. Okay, it's going to slow down as it goes through the water molecules because it's just not going to be able to travel as fast. What's vacuum? Nothing. Okay, it can travel through nothing faster than it can travel through a medium that has molecules in it where there are electric fields interacting. So its wavelength will change. That's why there's a subscript I there, because it's in some medium I. Okay, and that medium in our example is water. Okay, otherwise known as H2O. So it's in some medium, that wavelength is going to change. So the frequency staying the same, but all of a sudden the waves, it stopped going as fast, so the So the wavelengths are piling up on each other. The wavelengths got a little shorter. They're scrunching up on each other. And it's like Boston traffic, you know. Anyway. So then, if that changes, if the lambda changes, then something else in the equation has to change. And that thing that changes is the refractive index. Okay, the refractive index then becomes for us a measure of the ratio, you might say, or the difference between the light and its speed in a vacuum and the light and its speed in some other substance. So if it's water, okay, like we said here, and we'll call I is going to be water, then these two things have to change because this frequency stays constant and the speed of light in the vacuum is a constant. Okay, here's the number for the speed of light in the vacuum, depending on what units you'd like to use. This happens to be in centimeters per second. Okay, so it says down here at the bottom, electric fields in matter. Gases have electric fields, but gas molecules are kind of far apart from one another, right? They're not close together. So the interaction there is less. Liquids, the molecules are close together, okay? And so the electric fields that are present in that substance, in a liquid substances, are greater than in gases. And so there's more interaction in the case of liquids. And then if we get into solids, it's even more densely packed, usually. And although there's not a huge difference between liquids and solids, but there's a greater effect when you get to solids. Okay? So it says here, gases are kind of similar to a vacuum. There's not much change. But liquids and solids, there's a significant change. And that's why I went with water rather than air as my example. Okay, moving right along. This is a dispersion curve. And this is meant to help you understand. Now, I talked about the interaction between light and the electric vector of light and the electric fields in matter. You say, well, what is the specific nature of this interaction? It's very nonspecific. Okay, it's a non-specific interaction. It's an interaction, okay, but it doesn't really matter what the substance is that the light is passing through. We're not talking about a specific absorption band or a specific type of interaction. We're just talking about the fact that there are electrons in the matter that have electric fields that cause electric fields in the matter, and the electromagnetic radiation has an electric vector, and therefore you put the two together, and certainly there is a interaction between the two, but it's not specific. It's a non-specific type of interaction. The dispersion curve, just in very general terms, describes that sort of non-specific interaction that occurs. So it's our refractive index that we saw from the previous equation versus frequency. Right, and it tells us that if we change the frequency of light, that there are interactions that occur for different reasons. Okay, now we'll go through this and see what this is all about. So it's n as a function of frequency. Okay, now it says here on this slide, normally n increases with frequency, and this is referred to as normal dispersion. That was marked on the slide. We'll come back to that in just a minute. When absorption occurs, when there is an actual absorption process, and we'll get to absorption later on, then the nature of the interaction changes a little bit. It's not the same as just a very non-specific interaction. And so all we want to say is that this refractive index is a measure of the extent to which the electric vector interacts with the medium and causes that kind of slowing down process. So it says, for a given frequency in a medium, a larger n, a larger refractive index means more interaction with the electric field. And then we introduce this term polarizability. I'll mention this probably a couple of more times as we go on. But think of a molecule that has a big electron cloud that's easily influenced. The electrons are not held tightly. Think of iodine. Okay, iodine is a. If you look at the periodic table, and of course you realize that we're adding shells of electrons as we go down the periodic table. Or as if you looked at a chart of atomic radii, for example, you would find that fluorine is small, bromine is bigger, iodine, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, iodine, they get bigger, right, because of more shells of electrons. Well, something like iodine, the outer shell electrons are very loosely held by the molecule, by the atom. And therefore, those electrons are easily polarized. They're easily influenced by electromagnetic radiation as it comes by. So an atom in some molecule or by itself, like iodine, would be more readily polarized, or the electrons would be moved around more easily than something like fluorine, which is a high electronegativity, and those electrons that are around it are very tightly held and would not be moved by the interaction of light. So that's the concept of polarizability, the ability of the electrons to follow that electric vector and to be influenced by that electric vector. Okay, back to our curve. There are three trends I'm going to show you here. Three trends. Number one is this overall decrease. So this curve, this dispersion curve, starts up here and it's heading in this direction overall. If I just stand way back and I say there's an overall decrease in this dispersion curve. Well, one theory is that the reason for that overall decline of the refractive index with increasing frequency, these are significant numbers, right? 10 to the 15th is a big number. So that's frequency and hertz, oscillations per second. 10 to the 15th per second, that's a lot. Okay, I'm fast, but not that fast. So the idea is that as the oscillations get faster and faster, the electric fields in the matter have a hard time keeping up with those oscillations. And at some point, the ability of them to be polarized or to interact with that electromagnetic radiation becomes less and less and less because the fluctuations are faster and faster and faster. So that's one description or understanding of why there is a general downward trend in this dispersion curve. The next trend is the fact that what we talked about before is the normal dispersion. Regions where N increases with frequency prior to an absorption band. And so I've got that in red. And the idea is this just happens to be a very routinely observed phenomenon that we see or that occurs where there is a general increase in this trend or increase in this curve of frequency versus refractive index. This is referred to as normal dispersion. Okay, and then the third one is and decreases. Okay, refractive index decreases. Okay, at the absorption band. Right at where there's absorption occurs, and that's sort of anomalous, okay? And so we refer to that as anomalous dispersion because this interaction of light changes, and it's linked to that absorption process. All right, we'll leave it at that. All right, so this is this dispersion curve, and I'm trying to give you a flavor or an understanding of refractive index and what it's all about. Refractive index varies with wavelength. Variation of refractive index with wavelength for several types of glass. So if we take different wavelengths of light, which are here, and there's only a few, there's only 400 to 600 nanometers shown here, and we talk about the index of refraction for different materials, it would make sense that the material, because we define this whole thing as light, electromagnetic radiation, electric vector interacting with the electric fields in the matter, that if the matter changes, if the substance changes, then the refractive index is going to change. The magnitude, the value of that number is going to change. So if we have different kinds of glasses, so this is different types of glasses. There's lots of different kinds of glass, right? There's flint glass here. This is extra dense flint blasts, and then there's extra barium flint blasts. Okay, you put barium you dope barium into the glass, and then they have something here called barium flint. I don't know the difference. Then there's crown glass, borosilicate crown flint, different mixtures of glasses, or different mixtures of substances to make a glass type substance. All right, and we see that they're all different. They change a little bit. So it does matter what the substance is. Now you notice also that the glasses that we have listed here vary in a pretty narrow range from 1.5 to 1.7. So it's not, you know, this huge change. But then you go to, you know, some other substances, solvents, water, benzene, different solvents like that, you get to see different values for the refractive index. Oh, look, we got a table. Refractive indices for various substance at a particular wavelength, 589 nanometers, the wavelength is chosen as the D line of sodium. What's the D line of sodium? Well, once again, this is a throwback to the Dark Ages. Well, I guess it can't be the Dark Ages because we're talking about light. But it's a throwback to when spectroscopy got its beginning, and people said, how are we going to make... We can only do spectroscopy during the daytime because the sun is the only thing we have as a source. And then somebody came along and said, hey, we can make a light, we can make a lamp out of sodium metal, okay, and we put it inside of a glass tube. We know how to blow glass and do different things like that. And then we'll put a couple of electrodes in there, and we'll make a discharge, apply electricity to it. We'll get our friends, the electrochemists, to help us with this. And we'll apply some electricity, and we'll create a discharge inside of this tube where there's sodium, and it turns out to give off the spectrum of sodium. We'll talk about discharge lamps later on. And we can get the spectrum of sodium, and we'll isolate one of the lines of sodium. And it turns out that in the old days they gave the lines in the spectrum letters A, B, C, D. Oh, here's a nice line in the sodium spectrum that's easy for us to isolate, separate from the other wavelengths that are put out by sodium. So let's use that wavelength of light, which turns out to be 589 nanometers. We could probably get better resolution than that, 589 point something nanometers. And we can use that as a source for different kinds of measurements that we're going to make in spectroscopy. Now, I'm talking about, you know, doing this in the 1700s. All right? This is when they came up with this stuff. And they didn't know it was probably 589 nanometers. Somebody figured that out later. But they knew it was a reproducible wavelength of light that, boy scientists, who would be 300 years old if they were alive today, could reproduce in their little laboratories while they were trying to turn base metals into gold and make Frankenstein or something like that. Whatever they were doing in their laboratories, okay, they could make the sodium D line reproducibly, and now we could compare our results in America with the results across the pond in Europe, So that's why we have the sodium D line today. That's why all refractive index measurements are referenced to the sodium D line. Refractive index changes with wavelength. So if we're going to make measurements of a substance that we're going to compare or tabulate or whatever, we do it at the sodium D line, which is 589 nanometers. That was a long explanation and a lot of history there, but anyway. All right, so what are the values of the refractive index at 589 nanometers for different substances? Well, it says here, the value for air is almost exactly 1. Now, if we went back to the equation, 1.000000, however many zeros you want to put out the end of it, would mean that we had a vacuum, right? Because speed of light in a vacuum, it was 2.99 times 10 to the whatever, you know, centimeters per second. So if refractive index is 1, then we're talking about speed of light in a vacuum. If we get into a gas, like air, which is mostly nitrogen, some oxygen and other things, CO2 and argon and whatever, it's almost the same as a vacuum. So you can see that there's not much difference between what you would find in a vacuum and what you would find in some gas like air. It does vary out here in the fourth and fifth decimal places, and we can actually measure those with a good refractometer. But generally speaking, it's pretty close to a vacuum. We go to water, all of a sudden the number gets to 1.3 in that neighborhood. And again, temperature of the water matters because the density of the water matters. And if you have more dense water, then you're going to have more interaction. And we can measure this as a pretty sensitive parameter, this refractive index. So it's going to change if we're going to have more interaction with more dense water, which would be colder temperatures, and less interaction with higher temperatures. And so water at 20 degrees C has 1.333343s and a 6. If I throw some substance in the water, I dissolve something in there, throw a little salt in there, throw a little of some other solute molecule in there, I get a change in the refractive index. All of a sudden, I've got a refractive index detector for HPLC or some other purpose. But we can note or measure the changes in a substance like water, even small amounts of solutes dissolved in that water by changes in the refractive index. So refractive index detectors work okay for HPLC. They're not super sensitive, but they're pretty much universal. They'll measure about anything. So we can do that. We find out if we take a solid like a sodium chloride crystal, it has a refractive index of 1.5. Benzene, 1.501. Quartz, crown glass, ethyl alcohol, carbon disulfide, any substance you want, we can come up with a refractive index. And we can probably rationalize the value of that refractive index based on the density of the substance, the ability of its electron cloud to be polarized or interact with the electromagnetic radiation and so forth. Okay, so now you know more about refractive index than you ever wanted to know. The refractive index is a measure of the phenomenon known as refraction. So refraction is the phenomenon. Refractive index is the parameter that we measure. And we already said it's a change in velocity as the light goes from one substance to another. So here I got a little diagram, and the light beam, the light ray is coming in like this, and it hits the interface between one substance. So here we've got air, and here we've got a piece of glass. And the refractive index for the piece of glass is 1.5. That falls in that range that we saw a few minutes ago. Actually, it's the end of that range. And we know that in air, it's 1.00 something. So we're, you know, we'll drop off the last few zeros for the case of this last few decimal places for the case of our discussion here. But we see that because the light slows down, okay, there's a bending phenomenon that occurs. Okay, the refraction of light as it goes from one substance to another that has different refractive indices that slowing down manifests itself as a bending of the light or a change in direction of the light. So here we have the interface between the two substances. We got air up here. We got glass down here. This is just an imaginary line drawn to show you 90 degrees, what's referred to as the normal. Okay, the normal to the line to the interface, because we're going to measure things off the normal. We're going to measure things off of this imaginary line. And whatever the angle is of my incident light, the angle off of the normal, the angle down here is going to be less, assuming I'm going from lower refractive index to higher refractive index. Right? So the ray of light is bends toward the normal, going from lower to higher refractive index. This is what is referred to as the Snell equation. Okay, I didn't put that down, I don't think. Maybe it is. I don't know. But anyway, this is the Snell equation. Check your notes. If it's in there, I remembered to put it in. But I forgot to put it in my notes. So this is the Snell equation. And that just governs that whole process. If I'm talking about frequencies here, and I've got, it's defined in terms of frequencies, but it could be, we could convert that to wavelength. And here's my angles. all right, and my refractive indices for the two substances. If the substance one is air, which has a refractive index of one, then we can just talk about N2 and not worry about N1 because it's one and it drops out of our equation. Magnitude and direction of change, size of the angle depends on the wavelength. This is how a prism works. Okay, so this whole idea of refraction. So why are you spending so much time on refractive index? It's kind of important, actually. Refraction is how a prism works. Light of different wavelengths goes into a prism. White light, mixture of different wavelengths of light, goes into a prism and is refracted or bends to a different extent based on the fact that it has a different refractive index, or refractive index changes with wavelength. And so different wavelengths of light, according to the Snell equation, changes the bending. So now all of a sudden the white light, it all comes in at one incident angle, gets spread out, okay, and comes out of the prism at different angles, slightly removed from one another. So all of a sudden I spread the white light into the spectrum of light. And we get a dispersion of the light due to this refraction process, and that's how a prism works. And we're going to use prisms in our spectrometers, whether we're going to do, we're doing molecular spectroscopy, so let's keep it simple. Direction of bending depends on the value of the N for each medium. If we go from low to high, the ray bends towards the normal. If we go from high to low, refractive index, it bends the other way. And let's see. I have a description of that. Well, no, this is still low to high. This is good. Okay. This is the critical angle. And there is a critical angle defined by the fact that I said if light comes in at some angle, then it's going to bend closer to the normal. There's a limit. Okay, there's a limit to that bending based on the fact that going from low to high, there's always a bending toward the normal. So what I mean by that is, if I were to increase, so this incident light, and this is phi 1, if I were to increase phi 1, the maximum value I can have off of the normal for phi 1 is 90 degrees. Right? So if I increase this all the way down to here, the angle of incidence is 90 degrees, but the maximum angle of incidence that I can have off the normal is 90 degrees. So what's happening at 90 degrees is my light is coming in right at the interface, what is referred to as grazing incidence. It just skims along the surface. Now, if that's the maximum value of the incident light angle, or phi sub 1, then I have the maximum value that I get for phi sub 2. Okay? And again, we could go back to the Snell equation and do the calculation, but that's not the point. The point is that this refracted ray, okay, when the incident light is 90, okay, this phi 2 is what we're going to call the critical angle. Okay? It's the limit. Okay, there is no you can't get a larger angle, okay? Because if you do, you're inside the other medium. It's not refraction anymore, okay? So this defines the critical angle. Now, critical angle is of critical importance, and the reason it's of critical importance is because your fiber optic television connection that you get from Verizon works on this principle. Okay, right? It works on the principle of fiber optics. Much of our telecommunications today are done with fiber optic systems. Right? Instead of running wires, they ran one to my house the other day because I got tired of DSL and decided to go with a fiber optic based internet connection at home. So they came along and they took down the wires and they ran fiber optic cables. Okay, so now instead of electric signals going through the wires, it's light signals going through fiber optics. So what's this got to do with fiber optics? Okay, if I increase the angle of the incident angle, okay. I'll explain that in just a minute. I have another diagram that'll better explain how fiber optics work. But it's based on refractive index. Okay, it's based on refractive index. Also, this critical angle is important in refractometers. When you're measuring a refractive index, you need to measure. You're actually measuring the critical angle, and when you find the critical angle, then you can determine what the refractive index of the substance is. Okay, so. So this is the definition. This slide is really here just to tell you the definition of this term, the critical angle. I don't have the other slide handy. I'll talk about it later on. The idea is that let's go in reverse. If I were to reverse this, okay. If I were to go from a high refractive index to a low refractive index. If I were to increase phi 2 beyond the critical angle, the incident light that I'm coming in this direction would not escape. Okay, this would not happen. If I increase the critical angle, increase the angle of incidence phi 2 going in reverse. To greater than the critical angle, all of the light is reflected back inside of the medium. So, this is how a fiber optic works. I set up my refractive index of the fiber versus the material that surrounds the fiber, sometimes referred to as the cladding, sheathing. Okay, I'll talk about this again later on. But I just want to. This is important. That it's interesting. So if the angle is greater than the critical angle, all of the light is reflected back inside. So I get light inside the fiber, and it can't get out. As long as I keep the angle of incidence greater than the critical angle, the light cannot escape the fiber. So its only recourse is to travel down the fiber. So when we make fiber optics, we're doing is adjusting the refractive index of the fiber material and the material that's next to that, surrounding it. So I just make so if I'm a fiber optic manufacturer, and I can make fiber optic materials out of plastics, all different kinds of plastics, out of glass, out of quartz. All that matters is the refractive index of that material that the light is going to pass through and the material that's next to it, that's surrounding it. So I take a piece of quartz or a piece of glass or a piece of plastic and I surround it with a refractive index, a material that has a refractive index that's lower than the refractive index of that transparent material. And all of a sudden, if I keep the light angle greater than the critical angle, the light can't escape. It has to stay inside. It's reflected inside. And we'll talk about it when we talk about reflectance. And what happens is I get the light propagating down the fiber optic. It doesn't escape, right? In typical fiber optics, keep about 80% of the light, maybe some small percentage of it, as much as 20%, does escape or leak or is absorbed or absorbed by impurities in the material, whatever, and doesn't transmit down the fiber optic. Okay, so fiber optics are important, and it's the critical angle that's of critical importance in determining that. Okay, I wanted to tell you about wave interaction. We talked about waves of light. Waves of light can interact with one another. Sometimes it's referred to as superposition, the principle of superposition. It's also referred to as interference. Okay, light waves interfering with one another, and this diagram shows two light waves, Y1 and Y2, green and blue. They are of the same frequency, it turns out. They rise and fall at the same places. But they're offset. One starts, the green one starts a little earlier, and the blue one starts a little bit later. But if they're of the same wavelength and frequency, then the one that started earlier ends earlier, and the one that started later ends later. Actually, they don't end, they just keep going, but in my diagram they end. Those two waves of light, when they are superimposed on one another, can add. So Y1 plus Y2 gives the sum, Y1 plus Y2, shown here in whatever that color is. Is that magenta? You like that? Purple. We'll call it purple. So, vectors, remember we said there were little vector arrows, you know, vectors? Okay. Well, they add. Okay. So these are the blue ones. Okay. And you add those with the ones from the green one, and you get the purple. Vector addition. All right. Vector addition is how it's done. So even though they start at different, and we'll talk, we're going to talk about that right now, I guess. We're going to talk about the wave equation. Okay. The wave equation is shown right here. This is a simplified form of the wave equation. This is a more complicated form of the wave equation. It says Y, the location, wherever you are on the wave, okay, wherever you happen to be on this wave, if you're here, or, you know, see, this is the Y-axis, right? So wherever you happen to be on this wave, Y is equal to the amplitude of the wave, A, so A is amplitude, the sine of, and there are three parameters in here, omega is the angular frequency. There goes that Greek alphabet again. We got omega and alpha. Okay, omega is the angular frequency of the light, so it's not hertz, but it's angular frequency related to that. And then alpha is the phase angle. The phase angle is that where it starts. Does it start here or here, or where is it, how it's shifted along the axis? Right. And t is time. Our axis here says x, but this would be time. Okay, t. It would be a time axis. Okay? So, this describes, this equation describes a wave of light, one single wave. Where you are on the y-axis is denoted by the amplitude, the overall amplitude of the wave, the angular frequency, time, and the phase angle, which is basically where it's shifted left or right on the scale. Okay, if we have a bunch of waves, and we're going to see how they superimpose or how they interfere with one another, then we write the equation over and over again for every wavelength of light that we have, for every wave of light that we have, and that's going to give us our overall summing the value of y at any location along this along our set of axes, for the sum of the waves that are superimposed or that are interfering with one another. Okay? So this equation just defines what the wavelengths of light or how these wavelengths of light add together. Now, the phenomenon of interference is usually referred to as shown here. If we add two wavelengths of light, then we have constructive interference. So this is the same diagram as before. Green and blue add together to constructively to give you the purple. So that's constructive interference. The waves add. If they were out of phase with one another, if they were shifted so that the blue one goes up when the green one goes down, then they subtract from one another. Now they're still adding, but the net result is the vectors. The vector addition gives us a net subtraction. And the resulting wave is smaller. Okay, so that's pretty logical. This diagram is similar to the ones before, but this shows you maximum constructive interference. So these two waves, are the blue and the green, are perfectly in phase. They rise exactly at the same spot. They have their maximum at the same location. They go down and they have their minimum at the same location. When I superimpose those two waves, the resulting wave okay, gives me maximum constructive interference. The difference in their phase angles is zero. They're not shifted at all along the x-axis. They are superimposed exactly, and so they add perfectly to give the maximum amount of constructive interference. Right? Phase angle difference between wave 1 and wave 2 is zero. Alpha 1 minus alpha 2 is zero. Now, I can move the wave 360 degrees. I can move the phase angle one complete wavelength, and I still get constructive interference. Right? 360 degrees, I shifted the red wave over, and sure enough, they're still superimposed with one another, and I get the blue, in this case, the blue wave, and still maximum constructive interference. So 0 degrees, where there's no phase angle difference. 360 degrees, there's a phase angle difference, but it coincides with maximum constructive interference. And however, whatever multiples of 360 you want to use. Oh, look, we've got some here. Okay, 720, for example. All right. Then there's maximum destructive interference, where the red and the green wave are out of phase by 180 degrees, or 360 plus 180, 540, or any multiple of that. And so what we end up with is the red one goes up, the green one goes down, we end up with nothing. Two rays of light exactly out of phase with one another of the same amplitude and frequency meet, and what happens? Vanish. Okay, the light vanishes. There's no light. There's a dark spot. Okay, and you can do experiments with this. Kids do this in grade school with aluminum foil, and they make pinholes in it. You make two pinholes. You shine the light, okay, on the piece of aluminum foil. You turn the lights off in the room, okay, and those two pinholes project an image on the wall that's an interference pattern. There are light and dark bands. Because of the two pinholes become sources, and they recombine on the other side of the aluminum foil. Okay, so we got a piece of foil, two pinholes in it, and a light bulb. On the other side over here, when the light emanating from those two points recombines, we get some destructive interference and some constructive interference, and so you get light and dark bands. Okay, you can go home and try that. It's okay, or you can just remember back to grade school. All right. Now, why do we do all that? Because some genius named Fourier, okay, a French mathematician, came along and came up using the wave equations and some very complicated math, and he didn't even have a computer. Okay, he didn't even have an IBM PC. All right, what was he doing? Okay, he must have had a lot of paper or a big chalkboard. Anyway, he came up with a mathematical process by which you can take the waves of light, this process of combining waves of light, and sort out what's going on based on the interference pattern. And so what we do in a Fourier analysis, and fortunately for us, we're not going to go through the math, but we will talk about Fourier analysis a little bit. We'll talk about interferometry, the process of using the interference phenomenon to determine what the wavelengths of light are. Okay, it's fairly complicated. We throw all the light together. We basically cause the light to interfere, typically on some kind of a time frame. Okay, we change the time frame under which the interference occurs, and we get a complete jumbled mess of wavelengths. And then we sort it out mathematically to determine what the individual wavelengths of light are. And that's how Fourier did all this. I don't know. The guy's a genius. Right? He's also dead, but he was a genius. Okay. All right, so Fourier integral, Fourier transform, pretty important, okay, for FTIR, Fourier transform NMR. We have those kinds of instruments in this building. We do not have a Fourier transform mass spectrometer, but you can do mass spectrometry based on Fourier transform as well, and probably some other things also. Okay, Diffraction. Here's another phenomenon that we need to talk about. Electromagnetic radiation goes past an edge. So you have a light passing an opaque substance. Light doesn't travel through it. And as it passes the edge, or as it goes between a slit, okay, and comes out through like the pinholes I was telling you about, the light is diffracted. Okay, EM passing or two edges tends to spread. So the spreading is the diffraction. All right. So this diagram tells you the size of the opening, or the size if you have a pinhole or a slit that the light is passing through, relative to the wavelength of light. All right. Now this becomes important. If the D, the space between the openings, the light is coming along. This is meant to show wave fronts. So in between each one of these wave fronts is a wave. Okay, a wave of light, a wavelength of light. So the wave fronts hit this little space. If the space is smaller than a wavelength of light, the light spreads when it comes out the other side. It was straight before, now it's bent. By the way, if it stayed straight, remember the pinhole experiment where we took the aluminum foil? We were back in grade school, okay? And we poked the two pinholes in the aluminum foil. If the light stayed straight, okay, it doesn't do anything. There's no change. There's no interesting interference pattern. But if the light spreads like this as it comes out of the pinhole, so that's why it has to be a pinhole. It can't be a big opening because that's greater than the size of the wavelength of light. But if we make a pinhole, it gets down, approaches the size of the wavelength of light. And so as the light comes out, it spreads. And then if we have two of these openings, let's say this is the second opening, and light's coming out of this one too, this light's spreading. And then what happens here, there's interference, where the two spreading bands of radiation hit each other. Then we have an interference phenomenon occur, just like we talked about a few minutes ago with wave superposition or maximum constructive interference or maximum destructive interference. Now, the pinhole experiment, it's not a perfect experiment. Okay, you'd have to make the pinholes on the order of nanometers, hundreds of nanometers. Okay, I don't know, we'll have to measure that in the lab under the microscope, but you could make a pinhole that's on the micron size, probably pretty easy. But if you make it down to the a couple hundred nanometers, now you're in the range of the wavelength of light, right? So big light, red light, 600 nanometers. Okay, so if the light passes through the D spacing, the size of the hole is on the order of is in this case smaller than the wavelength of light, then we get this spreading and we get light and dark bands. The better the experiment, okay, in other words, the better the matchup of the D spacing to the wavelength of light, the more impressive the experiment is. You can actually get completely dark bands and completely light bands. That would be maximum constructive and maximum destructive. Maximum constructive gives you light bands. Maximum destructive gives you dark bands. If you make your pinholes too fat, okay, what happens is the experiment isn't perfect, and you get bands that are a little bit dark and bands that are a little bit light. And you can see the bands, but it's not as impressive. Right? So I'm just telling you how to do the experiment better. If the D spacing is similar to the wavelength of light, you don't get as much spreading. You get very little spreading. This shows no spreading. And you do get, this last column here shows the intensity. By the way, in the case of the intensity, you need a bright light bulb and you get very little light coming out the other end. You lose something. You always lose something in these experiments. But you do get spreading. If the D spacing is similar to the wavelength of light, you get more intensity with little side bands, okay, caused by diffraction. If the spacing is large, you get a big intensity in the middle and very small side bands. All right, this is all diffraction. Now, why do I spend all this time with pinholes and aluminum foil and light bulbs and all that kind of stuff? Because I'm a crazy guy, right? No. Because diffraction is an important phenomenon when it comes to diffraction gratings. Okay? Diffraction gratings are more important today than prisms for dispersing light in a spectrophotometer. If we're going to do UV visible absorption measurements, whether it's molecular absorption that we're going to talk about, or atomic absorption, infrared, or whatever we're going to do, all right? Most instruments today use diffraction gratings, not prisms. And we'll explain why later on. Prisms are used sometimes, but there's advantages to diffraction gratings. And we'll go into it now, but it's based on this diffraction process. It's based on spreading of light, and then you combine that with interference. So there's going to be two phenomena, interference and diffraction, that combine to make the diffraction grating work. Now, that question will be on the exam. Okay, and so those two phenomena are going to combine to make a diffraction grating work. Right? Now, there's another important reason. If I have entrance and exit slits in an instrument, you know, there's an entrance slit where the light goes in to a monochromator, to a wavelength selection device, and an exit slit where the light comes out. You make the slit too small, you're going to cause diffraction. You don't want to do that. You want the slits to be selecting the light, the wavelengths of light that you're going to use. Okay, let's talk about scattering. Okay, scattering is a phenomenon that can be defined in two ways. I'm going to define it in terms of the wave and the particle nature of light. It's an interaction of light with matter, so we're covering it under the spectroscopy category. But usually there's no change in energy without change in energy of the light. So light hits a substance, and it is scattered. Okay, it says here in the wave description that light hits the matter, the oscillating electric vector of the light interacts with the electric fields in the matter, those electrons and so forth, creates a virtual state. What's a virtual state? I don't know. It's a state that doesn't really exist, right? It's virtual reality. Am I really here, or am I just a hologram? Okay. It creates a virtual state, which is not the same thing as an excited state in absorption, but it's a state, okay, a virtual state, and it's short-lived, and the light interacts with the matter, creates this virtual state. The virtual state relaxes and re-emits the radiation, but when it re-emits it, the matter acts as a point source, and it sends the light out in all directions. Okay, so the light came in one direction and goes out in all directions. Right? And so that's the wave description. If we talk about a particle description, it says that... I confused my terminology here when I'm talking about this. But it's really the same description. Remember, wave and particle descriptions are we're describing the same thing. We're describing light. We're describing electromagnetic radiation. So I meant to say in the wave that we create oscillating dipoles and that re-emits in all directions. Or in the particle description, we create a virtual state and that re-emits in all directions. It's just the same thing. Okay, it's the same thing. It's just a wave description versus a particle quantum photon description of the same process. The light comes in, it hits the matter, it interacts with the electric fields of that matter, and then it comes back out going in all directions. If it creates a virtual state, that's normally associated with particles. That's where I confused the two. But if it creates an oscillating dipole, then it's the wave description. But it's the same thing. Right? Now, in the Raman effect, okay, Raman, Indian scientist, 1950, before I was born, invented this, okay, won a Nobel Prize later on for it. The Raman effect is classified as a scattering effect scattering phenomenon, but there is a change in energy. So up here, where I said without a change in energy, okay, the Raman is an exception, I guess. It's a scattering phenomenon. It's at the borderline. Scattering is technically not spectroscopy. It's interaction of light with matter, but you don't get a spectrum. It normally gives you the light at the same wavelength. But in the Raman effect, some small amount of the radiation actually is emitted at different frequencies. Okay, there's a change in the frequency of the light, a change in the wavelength of light that we observe. And so this is referred to as the Raman effect. And it's important, very complementary phenomenon compared to infrared spectroscopy. We're not going to spend much time on it, but here's the idea. For scattering, light comes in, hits a scattering center, okay, a molecule or a particle, and the light goes out in all directions, including back this way. There are many kinds of scattering, all right, and they're usually all defined in terms of the wavelength, the size of the wavelength of light, the length of the wave, versus the size of the scattering center, the particle or molecule. So we have Rayleigh scattering, large particle scattering, and techniques based on these, like dynamic scattering, multi-angle or low-angle LALS, low-angle light scattering, LALS, LALS, or MALS, multi-angle light scattering. Okay, all different techniques, all based on this concept of light coming in. Now, I'll tell you about these two. Rayleigh scattering is defined as scattering by particles whose longest dimension is less than 5% to 10% of the wavelength. So let's put this down. We're talking about ultraviolet and visible radiation. I'll talk more about the spectrum later on. But the ultraviolet, typically we use 200 nanometers on the low end, up to maybe 350. That's the ultraviolet region. Nanometers, so 200 to 350 nanometers. And then the visible region would go from like 350 up to 600, 700, 800 nanometers. All red, that's the red end of the spectrum. So we're talking hundreds of nanometers. That's the length of the wave. So now, if we have a particle in Rayleigh scattering that's less than 5% to 10% of the wavelength. So we're talking about nanoparticles, right? We're talking about particles that are in the tens of nanometers in size. Okay, so that's the particle size of the stuff. Now, if you stop and think about the size of atoms, okay, and the bonds that connect two atoms to make a molecule or multiple atoms to make molecules, we start to realize that molecules are in that nanometer size range. Okay, it's angstrom size range, maybe a little on the low end of the sub-nanometer size range, but an angstrom is 10-fold lower than a nanometer, right? There are 10 angstroms in one nanometer. So that's the kind of size. So Rayleigh scattering can occur for molecules. It doesn't have to be a particle. It doesn't have to be an insoluble, visible particle that we can see. It could be, but typically it can be a molecule. So you take water, pure distilled water. Nobody brought any water to class, huh? Poland Springs, you know, any kind of water, okay? Distilled water, all right? You shine light on it, in the visible UV region, you will get Rayleigh scattering. The molecules of water will scatter light because they're on that order of this range of less than 5 to 10% of the size of the wavelengths of light. You'll also get Raman. You'll also get a Raman band where you can measure the Raman band for water as well. Okay, here's this really ugly equation that tells us about the Rayleigh scattering. Scattering intensity is IS. The polarizability, because why is there polarizability? Well, whether you're talking wave or particle, whether we're talking virtual states or oscillating dipoles or whatever it is, you need electrons that are polarizable to create the virtual state or to polarize, to oscillate, to cause that to occur. So you got to have some polarizability. The more polarizability, the more scattering you get. It's a squared relationship to the scattering intensity. What else we got? Wavelength, lambda, of course. R is the distance from the scattering center to the detector that we're going to measure this light with, this intensity of scattering. Here's the angle. Okay, so theta is the angle between the incident beam and the scattered beam. So light scatters in all directions. So there's where we measure, okay, where we measure the light, scattered intensity is at some angle. It might be 180 degrees or 0 degrees to the source, to the incident beam. Let's see, what else we got? Incident beam intensity. So how much? This is directly proportional to this, right? I0 is directly proportional to IS. You get greater incident light, you get greater scattering. Just direct proportionality. And let's see, what else? That's everything, right? There is a fourth power relationship between the wavelength and the intensity, and this is why the sky is blue. Everybody knows that, right? Why isn't the sky black? At night, the sky is black. Why is it blue in the daytime? Must have something to do with the sun, you think? All right. Must have something to do with light coming in. Because at night, when there's no sunlight, the sky is black and I see stars. Okay. Back in grade school again, we're camping out and we're looking at the stars. All right. And so why is the sky not black during the daytime? Rayleigh scattering. The light from the sun comes in and hits stuff. That's a technical term. Okay, in the atmosphere. What does it hit? Water vapor, droplets, okay, dust particles, all kinds of stuff that's in the stuff. It's just stuff. All stuff that's in the atmosphere. And what does it do? It scatters. Okay, the light scatters. Well, why blue? Wouldn't you like to see an orange or pink or green? How about a green sky? Wouldn't that be nice? Okay. Well, it's blue because of the inverse fourth power relationship. Okay. The shorter wavelengths of light scatter more efficiently than longer wavelengths of light. All right. Plug the numbers in. Work it out. All right. So, although the entire spectrum of light comes in from the sun, all we care about is visible because that's all we can see, then the light at the shorter wavelengths is the most intense. So yeah, there's other wavelengths of light up there in the blue sky, but we see the blue the most intensely because it is the most intensely scattered according to the Rayleigh equation. Okay? So now we know why the sky is blue. Okay? Now why does the sky get red when the sun is setting? All right, that's a different class. We'll get to that one later. Okay, polarizability, measure of how well the frequency induces a dipole. So alpha tends to be large for large molecules. Don't confuse this alpha with the wavelength alpha. It's not the same thing, right? This is polarizability alpha. The wavelength alpha was a phase angle. Totally different. Has absolutely no relation to one another. Okay? Big molecules have bigger alphas because the electron cloud is spread out and more loosely held. So therefore, it's more polarizable. Okay, so that ends Rayleigh scattering. Now we have large particle scattering. This is for particle dimensions that are less than 10%. So that's where it's a little overlap, right? Rayleigh was greater than 10%. This is less than 10%, up to 1.5 times the wavelength of light. So this is big things. If the wavelength of light is 600 nanometers on the red end of the visible scale, then the particle could be 900 nanometers. It's almost a micron. That's big enough for me to pick up with some molecular tweezers. I'm kidding. Okay. A micron, that's big, though. You know, that's big enough for you to kind of pretty much see it. Right? There it is. It's right. It's there. Okay. So now we're talking about things, particles, not individual molecules or atoms, certainly not atoms, but molecules, particles, precipitated crystals, insoluble substances, denatured agglomerated proteins, whatever it is that will create a particle that's big enough, like this size. Okay, turbidimetry and nephelometry are the two techniques. They're fancy names. Turbidimetry is when you take a cloudy precipitated sample and stick it in your UV visible spectrometer and you measure how much light is cut off by those particles. It's like doing UV visible absorption, except it's not UV visible absorption. It's scattering that causes. So it's a different process. The effect is the same. I shine light and not as much light comes out the other side of the cuvette. Right? I shine light on a cuvette full of sample. It's all cloudy. And on the other side of the cuvette, not much light comes out. It's not absorption, it's scattering. But it's measured the exact same way. That's turbidimetry. Nephelometry is when I take a fluorescence instrument, a right angle, usually right angle measurement, and I stick the same cloudy cuvette in there, and I measure the amount of light that's scattered at right angles, and that is nephelometry. Okay? But it's not fluorescence. That's causing the light to be there at the right angles. It's the scattering. And you can use any conventional fluorescence instrument to do nephelometry or any conventional UV visible absorption instrument to do turbidimetry. It's just measuring scattering. It's hard because sometimes stuff that scatters settles out. So you shake it up, put it in there, make your measurement quick. Okay. Large particles do not act as a point source. Because I showed you before a diagram. Wow. Okay, this was the diagram like a point source. Okay, well, this was sort of like the Rayleigh case, right? Large particles do not act as a point source, but they give rise to interference phenomenon. So instead of having equal amounts of scattering all the way around the particle or the molecule, in large particle scattering, I end up with different amounts of radiation at different angles coming off of this non-point source type large molecule or large particle that's giving rise to the scattering phenomenon. So this gives rise to the technique of multi-angle light scattering. You go down the hall, I think it's on the fifth floor still, and you find some of these polymer guys down here, okay? And they've got at least two, maybe three instruments made by a company called Wyatt. Wyatt makes these light scattering instruments that you can either hook up to a HPLC and you do size exclusion chromatography of the polymers, and then you measure the light that's scattered off of those big polymeric molecules at maybe three angles. You use a laser and you shine the laser on the sample as it comes out of the column, and you measure at three different angles, and it tells you not only that there's a molecule there, but that the molecule has a certain size and shape based on the different measurements at the different angles. They also have an instrument that measures like light at 10 different angles. Okay, and that instrument has the ability to measure molecular weights. Okay, and both of them have the ability to measure molecular weight. Why? Because of this interference phenomenon, Wyatt has figured out how to use the interference phenomenon, the fact that the light intensity is not the same at the different detectors that are around that detector cell where the sample is. So you shine a single light source in and you measure at different angles. And because of the interference phenomenon, you get different intensities of light at the different angles, and you can calculate the size of the molecule, whether it's a large particle or not. Okay? It says here, forward scattering becomes greater than the back scattering. If you want to know a lot about it, go to Wyatt's website and look up. Personally, I don't think they give a great description of it, but anyway, they sell instruments.